SAFM Market Update with Moneyweb. Understanding the markets has never been easier.
Good evening and welcome to the SAFM Market Update with Moneyweb, presented by myself, Nastasia Arendse. Coming up tonight, we have a special edition of the show. We're going to be talking about the National People's Congress, and that's in China, and the decision they made where about 3,000 delegates of the People's Congress, that is China's legislature, voted unanimously to end a two-term limit on the presidency, which is one of the main leadership posts held by Xi Jinping. We'll be talking to Dr. Martin Davis from Deloitte, and we'll also be looking at what that term limit means for other African countries, rather, and what precedent it sets. All of this is coming up. Welcome back to the show. As I mentioned in the intro, we're going to be talking about the National People's Congress, which is China's legislature that voted to end a two-term limit on the presidency. Now, while the overwhelming approval by the party-controlled Congress was not a surprise, the repercussions go beyond just allowing President Xi Jinping to stay on longer. I'm joined on the line by Dr. Martin Davis from Deloitte to talk about what is at stake and why ending the term limit matters. Dr. Martin Davis, thank you so much for your time. Let's start off by, you know, were you surprised that the National People's Congress voted in this way?
Look, I'm slightly surprised by it. I think the political predictability of succession in China has certainly underpinned the fantastic economic growth story since reform began in the very early 80s. Mm. Now, to tweak or to change that approach, i.e. 2 5-year terms per president, is potentially destabilizing. Mm. And, you know, I'm not quite sure the reason of it. It seems to be a bit of a, clearly a power grab by Xi Jinping. But I think it's, in recent years, we've been talking about the Washington consensus, which is political economic liberalism. Mm. This was a counter narrative to that was the Beijing consensus, which was more statist in approach. Now I'm afraid, particularly with the relative decline of the political appeal of Western countries, this move by China sets a pretty bad example, I think, for other developing economies, or leaderships, rather, from developing countries, think Africa, who feel that they can perhaps do the same. It's not a good precedent to copy.
Right. I mean, she came in, say, November 2012, if I'm not mistaken. I mean, how would you have described his leadership in China's economy and political front since then and the role he's played in strengthening the authority of the government and his position?
Look, I think Xi Jinping has been incredibly good for China the last 5-6 years. Mm-hmm. I don't mean that doesn't justify a lifetime presidency, however. But what has been extremely good, I think, firstly, is to stabilize the fiscus of the country following the particularly excessive spending following the 2008 financial crisis globally. That was the first fix, if you will. Mm. I think, secondly, is the issue of addressing corruption head-on. I believe that Xi Jinping truly believes that the country's future trajectory is impossible without the Chinese Communist Party. Mm. And the Chinese Communist Party, to be able to maintain the leadership position, has to root out corruption in its ranks. And there's nobody in China's history, or practically any political history anywhere, who has been so severe and so strict on rooting out corruption. The numbers are approximately 1.3 million people in the last 6 years have been charged, arrested, and jailed for corruption in China. Mm. So it really is cleaning up the act. I think the third area is that of the of reform of state enterprises. Arguably, the first presidency of Xi Jinping was around consolidating power. Why? Does the end justify the means? The end being rapid reform of the state and state enterprises, and to be able to challenge those vested interests that exist in China, mm. politically and economically, in state enterprises, one has to have pretty strong power to do so. And I think he's now in that position to do that. So I think in the second term, and maybe last, of Xi Jinping, we will see the next phase will be dramatic reform of what are effectively often non-productive, often moribund state-owned enterprises in the economy.
I've heard the argument that this decision sort of reverses the clock, as it were, on what was themed collective leadership. And this was, I think it was put together by Deng Xiaoping, specifically engineered to prevent the rise of another Mao-like figure. When you look at Xi and you look at his predecessors, are there striking differences amongst all of them from ones you can remember?
I don't think China's not a dictatorship at all. We shouldn't fall into even a one-man play. Yes, Xi Jinping is the most powerful president in Chairman Mao, or head of state, or head of party in Chairman Mao, but it doesn't make it a dictatorship like many other countries that, you know, come to mind. I think the yes, China may lack sort of checks and balances in the Westminster parliamentary democracy type style, you know, sort of organizational structure. But I know for a fact that in these state council meetings, which is effectively the cabinet, there are constant running arguments around policy decisions. And to assume that this is some sort of constant rubber stamping of Xi Jinping's will, I'm afraid is very, very superficial and just become wrong. So consensual, you know, maybe that's a slight exaggeration, but there's certainly, and contrast this to our cabinet in recent times, I suspect, there's certainly very robust debate in the Chinese State Council around policymaking and the future sort of future of the country, decisions that are made affecting the future of the country, arguably far more than many nominal democracies in recent times.
Right. At the same time, there are these tariffs that President Donald Trump has instituted, and then the retaliation from China. Do you see more tensions between the U.S. and China?
Look, I think this is, you know, it's people talk around G20, and I often half joke the only G that really counts is G2, and that, you know, China and the U.S. China's a rising great aspirational power and is increasingly acting as such. The U.S. is no longer the unilateral. We had this unilateral, unipolar world post, arguably, 1991 from the collapse of the Soviet Union. Now we're easing into a bipolar world, very much so. It's already arrived. The forecast is by 2022, which is nearly 4 years away, the largest single importing economy globally will be the Chinese, no longer the American. So who will then be dictating the terms of trade? Arguably Beijing, more than the U.S. So I think this has major implications, and I'm afraid countries are going to, peripheral countries, of which we are one, will have to choose sides. We're seeing pressure already being placed in Beijing, which used to be very, and this is another sort of, I think, outcome of the Xi Jinping presidency. Chinese foreign policy used to be very accommodating. Chinese foreign policy is increasingly assertive and almost forcing Asian countries to choose sides between the West, so to speak, including Japan, and all falling into China's own political sphere of influence. I think African states is increasingly contested and uncertain, and South Africa literally sits between two worlds here, political history versus economic reality and a commercial reality. And I think if we start to think about our own country's place in this new emerging world order of G2, I think we have to make some very clear and well thought through strategic decisions going forward.
Yeah. I was talking with an economist yesterday, and I was trying to figure out, I mean, you know, we hear these terms, trade war, and I've read a couple of books about whether there are any winners or losers in this game. From your perspective, are there any winners? And if there are any gains for a country that, you know, institutes trade wars, are these short-term gains from, you know, your expertise as an economist to an extent?
Look, are there any winners? I think generally I'm a free market fundamentalist, and trade ultimately lifts all boats, albeit at different speeds. I think I'm surprised that it's taken the U.S. this long to institute trade action against the Chinese, particularly in light of the steel sector and traditional heavy industry in China. Think cement, think steel, and the like. China's export competitiveness, largely in steel, a great example, comes from overcapacity which results from, has resulted from very distorted state intervention and financing in the economy in China. So this overcapacity results in dumped export, if you will. And that's what China, amongst many other, or the U.S., amongst many other countries are having to endure, ourselves very much so as well. So, you know, are there any winners from this? I don't think so. I mean, it swings and roundabouts here. It's called trade deflection, of course. You know, I think China's ultimately a pragmatic player, arguably far more pragmatic than Donald Trump would ever be. And I think we're not going to be, there's a bit of brinkmanship, of course, involved, a lot of threat.
Yeah.
But both economies, ultimately, U.S. and China, know that the trade underpins everything. U.S. less so, but China more so. That trade remains not the primary driver of growth in either economy, but is very, very important to both. And particularly the far further down the road, in terms of the development of the economic growth that U.S. multinationals are, than Chinese multinationals, I think there's a lot more pressure on Washington, D.C. to concede and not instigate a trade war. Because ultimately, countries don't trade, companies trade. Countries just set the rules. And I think that U.S. multinationals will have a lot more to say on this matter in the event of rising tensions, increasing tensions even more between Beijing and Washington, D.C.
We're going to take a quick ad break, and we're still joined by Dr. Martin Davis from Deloitte. We're going to be looking at President Donald Trump's possible meeting with North Korean despot, that is Kim Jong-un, after the break. Welcome back. You're listening to the SAFM Market Update with MoneyWeb. I was just thinking of North Korea and the leader of North Korea, because I mean, I think I saw a few weeks ago there was articles going around that there might be a potential meeting between President Donald Trump and the leader of North Korea. And I just wondered now, as you speak, whether that sidelines China in any way or lessens the leverage that China may have on the U.S. if this meeting happens. What do you think?
Well, you know, look at this is a broader strategy of the U.S. around containing China post 1949 in Asia. So think Japan, think South Korea, Japan in Okinawa, think South Korea, think Philippines, think Singapore, think Taiwan, down, think Philippines. The U.S. effectively has China circled with U.S. military installation, naval, air force, army bases, etc. And South Korea is increasingly the focal point of this. It's not in China's interest, it's not in Japan's interest to have a unified Korea. This North Korea challenge, the way the North Korean situation played out, is not just a consequence of sort of the leadership's actions in Pyongyang and Washington, D.C., but there's some very, very deeper strategic historical reasons as to why the situation remains as is between North and South Korea. So I read in the Chinese press today that Kim Jong-un, the head of state of North Korea, was in Beijing today with, you know, secret visit, but nevertheless, it's hard to keep things secret in Beijing when you're traveling around in a motorcade or in your private train and all the Chinese on social media. So, you know, it's North Korea will continue to be an intractable problem. The flare-ups of tension have been going on for the last, you know, literally that's 40, 50 years. I don't expect them to subside anytime soon, no matter what Beijing's intervention will be, or how Kim Jong-un is contained and how the U.S. reaction is going to be as well.
I was looking at the numbers following the, you know, the voting to amend the Constitution, and I think the numbers were just over 2,900 that were for. There were two that voted against and three abstentions. And, you know, it's a weird thing because you kind of wonder whether there was any, there were two people who voted against it, but whether there would be any dissent on the ground on this decision. And would they be, from your view, if something were to go wrong with the economy, like if perhaps the three top things that she wanted to work on suddenly couldn't work out, do you think that there would be any protests on the ground?
No. I don't think so at all. I think the opposition or the dislike, perhaps, or the disagreement, probably a better word, amongst the extension, the potential for the extension of presidential term, is significant and widespread across China. Of course, there's a reluctance, and I've been kind of using that word, to express that disagreement with what has taken place. But don't think there's any political opposition or, dare I say, political alternative to the Chinese Communist Party in China. It's not. I would argue that, you know, there's no future, really, of you know, there's no political economic future in China without a Chinese Communist Party in power. It's just a question of which faction. So don't think Western style there's going to be some sort of dramatic political change or 1994 South Africa style. It simply ain't going to happen, no matter what happens in China, no matter how big the crisis or not going forward.
What do you think Xi's, I suppose, role will be when it comes to African countries and the role China plays on the continent versus the role the US may have? Because, I mean, you know, there have been questions as to how Trump may view African countries and whether he sees, you know, any sort of partnerships between the US and Africa, or is it more partnerships between China and the continent?
Look, I think the West, and I'm talking about sort of Anglo-Saxon West here, Washington, D.C., London, are disengaged from Africa. Clearly, Donald Trump is not particularly interested. And the last time a British prime minister came to this continent was 4 years ago. Of course, I would contrast that by saying, yeah, the French are much more actively involved in Francophone Africa, Francophone West Africa. And the Germans, as of last year, with the G20 chair, were very pro-Africa and engaging with Africa. Angela Merkel was. But generally speaking, from the US and UK perspective, they've disengaged the continent. And this has been created a significant vacuum that the Chinese haven't had to try very hard to fill, to be honest. Their foreign policy is consistent, not depending on 4 or 5 yearly annual cycles, or 4 or 5 year cycles, as it is in Western countries, with political change or potential for change. Xi Jinping undoubtedly has, let me use this word carefully, tweaked it's the China's Africa policy. This is less wastage of Chinese taxpayer money in Africa, expected higher returns on projects, the hurdle rates, etc., and a general, more conservative approach towards the continent financially than what was characterized under the Hu Jintao presidency the previous 10 years, pre-March 2013. So, going forward, China will continue to engage the continent as it has for the last 18 years in terms of its relatively new, well, almost generation now, Africa strategy, Africa policy, but don't expect any great changes either way or any swing. China is, if anything, but consistent.
Do you have any concerns when you look at the, I suppose, this new term limit abolishing? Are there any concerns for you?
As I said earlier, I don't think it's a smart idea. China is run not by individuals, it's run by very, very vast institutions. And, you know, I don't mean that if that's a real or perceived assertion by myself, it should not be undermined. Confidence should not be undermined by creating political risk. Why would you want to do that? So, you know, when Museveni does it, we sort of don't think it's a good idea. And I think similarly, so we can't accept the same principle in Beijing either. So it's, I would not advise it. I don't think it's a good idea, to be honest. Let's see how this plays out. And I don't think any country should be, country's future should be determined by a single individual, no matter how good he or she are or think they are.
And I suppose on the positive side, are there things you're looking forward to Xi getting on track or doing with the economy or when it comes to international relations with other countries? What are some of the things you would think would be a plus that you'd look out for?
I think two things, and they're related to South Africa. Firstly is now that he has an extremely strong power base, and the Xi Jinping comes from the very bottom, the grassroots of the party. I mean, he fully understands how the party operates. He's seen corruption at every single level and how it functions and how it creates a dysfunctional state, and he's addressed that in the last 6 years and continues to do so. I think two things going forward. Firstly is the I use this word intentionally, the radical reform now of state-owned enterprises, i.e. shutting them down even more, and really sort of marketizing, commercializing dare I say, privatizing large numbers of SOEs across China next 5 years. I think that'll be dramatic. And then secondly, and relevant to South Africa, the first example also is relevant to South Africa, SOE within Chinese style. The second is this Belt and Road Initiative, BRI, or sometimes called OBR, One Belt, One Road.
Mm.
It's a big, classic sort of, you know, typical grand strategy of the Chinese. There's not much detail to it, just a big picture sort of intention. But South Africa, we've been so distracted by our own internal political machinations in recent years, compounded by a total lack of creativity and thought, intellectual thought around our foreign policy. And I'm afraid we've lost the plot, lost sight of the board, at least, in terms of what is our own political economic neighborhood called Africa. Mm. So the Chinese, as we know, the West Virginia disengaged. The Chinese have filled the vacuum. Why is South Africa, Inc., if you will, not filling that vacuum? Where's our vision thing? So how does South Africa play or project interest, more from a realistic scenario, our politics, how do we project interest into the African region with in light of China's own presence in key industries, in the infrastructure and the like, and mining, in the continent, and telecoms in the continent, under the guise of One Belt, One Road? Has there been much policy thinking amongst our decision makers and policy makers in South Africa? And more importantly, has there been much action? I'd like to see both going forward.
Thank you for listening to the SAFM Market Update, and thank you to Dr. Martin Davis, who joined us tonight to look at the new developments that are happening in China and to also talk to us about North Korea as well. That's it from myself, Nastasia Aronson, the rest of the MoneyWeb team. Good night.